So I'd like to just consider how we pay attention to things. Because we're always talking about mindfulness, awareness. So consider, let's say, that you're up on the escarpment in Gatineau. You're up in the park. Many of you have been up to some of those lovely open spaces where you're looking out at Ottawa Valley. Big, big space. And suddenly on stage right, a couple of vultures come floating in on the up currents. The up currents are going up the escarpment. And you're taken by the two birds flying. They're below you. And they're just flying. You're completely taken by that. And you're making no comment. You're bright, you're attentive. You don't want to own the vultures. You're not rushing around finding a camera to get a picture so you can hold on to it. Right? You're just totally with that movement in nature. And I think we've all had that. And there's a tremendous amount of calm in there. Tremendous amount of stillness in that. You're taken by the object, yet you don't want to own the object. They consider that then as you're sitting there, then you say, well, I want to get a picture of this. And you look for your camera. All of a sudden you become agitated because you want to own that experience. So you want to have that experience and share that experience. Or let's say you're a birder and you've never seen any turkey vulture. Right? You're from Missouri or somewhere. Turkey vultures there, but and so you get your birding book out and then you look at it and you look at it for a reason because you want to get certain features, you want to figure out what it is, you want some information. That's one way that we look. We look at things in order to get something from them, information or whatever. But then your mind is also agitated, not in a bad way, but you're kind of thinking about it and so on. And then you go back to just observing just this movement in nature, and your mind comes to stillness. And then someone comes and sits behind you with a cell phone, right? And you're really one with the vulture. And also, meet me, the cell phone starts to ring, and the person behind you can't see, starts to talk to their tailor about a suit they're going to make. Blah, 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 blah. Now your attention then is drawn by the fellow behind you, but it's usually drawn in a certain way. It's drawn with aversion, because you want the beauty of the natural scene. Now the sound is to you, it's annoying, not to him, or to her. But then it's not true. So it's annoying, it's unpleasant. So you're attending to that sound in a different way. You're attending to that sound with a sense of, I don't want this here, I don't want that there, with aversion. And in meditation, we're really trying to cultivate this way of attention, which is very fresh when the vulture first comes on the scene. When the bird first comes on the scene. A way of attention which is not bound by wanting anything out of this particular experience, not wanting to get rid of it, right, centered awareness, without any kind of doubt, just very much with the scene. Now it's easy to do that in instances of beauty. It's hard to sustain even in instances of beauty. It's very easy to do when it's pleasant. It's more difficult to do if with the telephone. But the same principle applies. You can sit there and you can observe, you're observing the natural scene, and then all of a sudden the person behind you starts to speak. You can bring your mind the same sense of non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion type of attention to the sound of a telephone. If you're willing to give up what you want. if you're willing to give up the aversion. And you can come to the same sense of quiet knowing around something which is unpleasant. It's more difficult, right? But it is possible. Now, the teachings, I think, in some of samadhi around the hindrances are like that. If you think about the five hindrances, they're greed and aversion, dullness, restlessness, and doubt. Dullness and restlessness, you're not really with the moment. You're agitated, you want to go somewhere else, you want to be somewhere, you just can't settle. With dullness, you're too settled. You're falling asleep. But when you're looking at the vulture, you're very with it, but you're not tense. But you're really kind of appreciating this. Aversion and greed. You're looking at the bird flying, and you're appreciating it in a particular way because it's beautiful. It has an attractive quality. But what your mind is also doing, because it can't really own it, you can't buy it unless you want to take a picture of it, unless you don't have a camera. You're with it without aversion and without greed. And hence you can be with it. If you have any aversion to vultures, and you say, well, that's awful, or if you want to own it in some way or figure it out or do something with it, then your mind is very, very busy. And this particular way of paying attention is I think what we're trying to train in meditation. We're trying to train our ability to pay attention in a particular fashion. In a particular fashion, freed from the hindrances. Freed from greed and aversion, freed from dullness and restlessness, freed from doubt. And then we're trying to apply that to situations where normally we might be reactive. So just as I can notice if you take that example, I can notice the bird flying below me on the escarpment. That's easy to look at with a calm mind. The guy with the telephone is a bit more difficult, but actually not so difficult. Unless I'm totally deluded. And I really believe that my aversion is somehow profound. But if I'm practicing Dhamma and want to free my mind from aversion, pretty soon I say, I'm not going there. That's just sound. And then I'll come to that sense of, rather than, you know, you can use any sense in this example, in the seeing there's just the seeing, and the hearing there's just the hearing. I can just, this is just sound. So when I talk about introducing the meditation, so just bring your mind to listening. Just listening. And notice how that right away it takes you to a sense of calm. Okay, just listen now. So I hear the rattle of the fan and so on and so forth, but it's just listening. Non-greed. Non-aversion. Right? No doubt. No dullness. No restlessness. Just presence. And I can train in that. I can train in that listening for spans of time. And that calms the mind. But as soon as I pick up the hindrances, I don't want the sound. Am I getting anywhere in my meditation? Doubts? Or I don't have the vitality to keep that sense of attention. I fall into dullness. Then I lose that state of mind or that possibility. So that is, I think, a kind of a way of looking at what we're trying to do in the meditative life, is look to train the mind to be with life in this particular way. So the phone rings, and the first impulse is aversion, but because I'm trying to practice right attention and right concentration and right mindfulness and right awareness and so on, then I notice that aversion is extra. That's something that I'm bringing to the situation. It's something I'm putting on top of it. I'm creating it. And because I want to free my mind, I say no. I let go. I let go of the aversion. Now that's easy because it's not terribly personal. It's not terribly threatening. It's not terribly painful. Right? But the same principle then applies to more difficult things, more complex things. So moods of the mind. We not only do we hear sounds, telephones and such like, and see birds flying, we experience moods of mind. Now, the bird, you see the bird's an object of sight, yes? The sound, you hear the phone, it's an object of listening, of sound, right? Well, let's say you have objects of mind, and one of the objects of mind might be something like fear. It's a vulture. It's a telephone, right? It's the same. It still can be known. It's still an object that can be known. It's more difficult, and it's easier to notice a picture as a visual object. But just as that can be known as a visual object with a black frame, etc., so also a mood of the mind, a citta, a type of mood, can also be known as an object. And I can know this is fear, and this is excitement, and this is inspiration, and this is boredom. I can know there's a difference, isn't there? Just as there's a difference between a vulture and a parakeet and the sound of a fan. They're different objects. But the way I pay attention to them, very much depends, usually, for the untrained mind, on whether I like them or dislike them. Whether I want them or I don't want them. And that's the untrained mind, because the untrained mind, which simply responds to liking and disliking, wanting and not wanting, is just the victim. So when the beautiful, this beautiful scene of a bird fly, I don't know, maybe not birds, but for me, this beautiful scene comes by, I'm happy. Because it's beautiful, my mind is still, right? And then this idiot behind me blames the Lord, and I go, we're going to have to get rid of old telephones, because I don't like it. So then I just become a victim. So then my pleasure in life, or the beauty of life, or the stillness of life, sometimes I touch it, but often I don't. Because there are so many other things, intruding on consciousness, which are not to my liking, not to my wanting, not to the patterns which I would want. This is the untrained mind. But the trained mind has a great potential, not just to be a victim. So back to the moods of the mind. We call that citta, the various moods that come into consciousness are more difficult to notice because we get so enwrapped by them or caught up by them. A mood of doubt, a mood of resentment, a mood of being belittled, a mood of inspiration, and so on. These are very fast and very quick, and very quickly what happens in consciousness is we become so enmeshed in them that we create a sense of a self, a sense of an I, or a psychological self. So, I'm sitting in meditation, and a doubtful mood comes up. If I know that it's just a doubtful mood, I watch that like I watch the vulture, the mood moves on. But if there isn't that kind of attention, which is clear and present and free from greed and aversion and so on, and I'm not attentive, and my mind's not trained around the condition of, say, doubt, then I can very easily pick up the doubt and create a sense of self around it. Well, should I be doing this or shouldn't I be doing that? Am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? And my mind becomes attached to the mood of doubt, and a sense of me begins to occupy consciousness in a very, very doubtful manner. And then maybe I hear a Dharma talk, or a teacher talks to me, or I read a book, and then I feel inspired. So that inspiration is much nicer than the doubt. So then I try to hold on to the inspiration. And I create a different kind of a sense of the self. I like to call these psychological selves. And I've got it. Now I figured it out. Now I know. Now I know. I know. If I just do this, I'll be right. I'll be always right. I'll be okay. I'll be okay. I'll be okay. And that's just another kind of vulture. Or red hawk. Or whatever. It's just another animal consciousness object in mind. But if I don't see that, that it also arises and ceases according to causes and conditions, and I go for the inspiration, then as soon as I hit that again, I'll really crash. Because I've assumed now I've really got it. I've figured it out. And I really sussed this. I've got insight. And this is it. And then, and then that goes, and then there's a doubt, oh no, I've lost it again, I'm hopeless. And the stronger I grab the inspiration, the stronger I will grab the doubt. And the more, the strong sense of self will come and go, come and go, and come and go. And, which is suffering, isn't it? Suffering. The rules of the mind are very powerful, very insidious, they're very, very much conditioned childhood, from various places. And they're very important to understand in our own understanding of ourselves. And it might just be simply one like perpetual mood that comes up. So a lot of people might just walk around town in a perpetual kind of sense of anxiety. You know, is this going to be right? Or am I going to soak this up? And just this kind of low-scale worry all the time. And a sense of self-thinking all the time. Worry. Not huge things, but just enough to tick the sense of self over. Just ticking over. And sometimes we can live in these kinds of realms, you know, for hours. The mind just mulling over, worried. And so basically it's worried. Not to some extent we can't function, so drive a car, food, smile, be nice, be charming, worry in the background. Maybe what we can do. So the first thing is always to try to, in the training of consciousness, in the training of mind, what we're trying to do is to awaken to the moods of the mind. So we have our social dharma, we have to practice precepts, and we have responsibilities and so on, and then we have the dharma of the phenomenon of consciousness, and one of the phenomenon of consciousness that we all experience are the different moods, right? So if I can understand some of the basic moods of my life, and I can see how that mood creates a sense of a self, and I can begin to say, that's what it's doing, and I can step back and look at it with non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, and that's the delusion, I begin to have freedom around the moods of the mind. And I can begin to choose moods of mind. I can choose a mood. And when I choose a mood, that's not from delusion, that's from skill. So I can choose a mood such as acceptance, let's say. So my mind begins to be worried about my own health, or the health of my family, or the health of the planet, or whatever. And I can see my mind starting to worry, and I see that. I see that as an object. I don't create a sense of self around it. And I can say, yeah, it's worrisome, but I'm going to work with this moment. I'm going to accept this moment just the way it is and work from here. Now that's a shift. That's a choice I make, not from aversion, but from wisdom. Because why? Because I've understood that mood of worry, maybe, and I've worked with it maybe for years. You can't just shift these things. You know, you have to really train the mind. And then I see that as unskillful. I see the worry and a sense of self and all that as unskillful. Maybe I just notice it in the body. I notice the body getting tense, and I make a choice. And that is skillful karma. A skillful choice towards acceptance, towards compassion, towards generosity, towards whatever you like. But you do it out of your skill rather than it being done to you from habit, from negative habit, from habitual habit. The same with the body. You know, we can observe the body as we observe those scenes in nature. We can let the body kind of come to us, and I talk about this very often. But like when you're sitting in meditation or when you're speaking with someone, if you develop a facility to let the body speak to you, to let the body become conscious, because sometimes in meditation you're asked to like sweep through the body. So, you know, someone says, look at your head, and look at your knee, and look at your ankle, look at the bottom of your foot. And quite often what we're doing is we're looking for something. Right? We're in this kind of mode of trying to find something rather than allowing something to come to us. If I'm looking at the bird and I'm trying to figure out what color the head is, okay, that's okay. I can do that. The color of the head is red. But this way of paying attention when we're utterly receptive is something that we're not much, I think, educated to. And we come upon it, you know, we come upon it in nature, don't we? We turn a corner and we see a rapids. Or we turn a corner and we see a large tree. Or we're sitting in meditation and we hear the loon, right? And so our mind stops. The mind is stilled by that. Now it's the beauty that does that, but the beauty is actually pointing to something in us is that stillness. And in that stillness, we're not demanding anything of this object. The object takes us to the stillness. In this kind of still center of being, or just the stillness of being. So, can I train the mind in this sense of still attention with difficult things like moods, like pain, say? You know, as soon as, if you're meditating, then, like, I've had a headache all day, right? That's why it's so quiet and hard. Just this, you know, headaches are such a drag because they're in your head. And just to sit with utter, like looking at the vulture. Just, okay, you want to float through here? Fine. Just with utter receptivity around the headache. Just that. Right? Now, a headache is something I don't want. And I drink lots of water and I do what you do for a headache. Pain is a part of it, isn't it? Pain is a part of the curriculum. Is there a way to be with pain where we still take care of the body and so on, but then we learn to use that even to bring the mind to stillness, to use pain to bring the mind to stillness? That's all, isn't it? But if we're going to have pain, sometimes it's just too difficult to work with. So say, I think Kuslo, this chemotherapy, I mean, it's such a wrong place. There's a lot of pain. It isn't quite often, but at times, right? At times, when you have some pain, like a meditation say, if your hip starts to hurt, right? Let's say 15 minutes into the number, right? You know it's an hour, and your hip starts to hurt. What does your mind do? Well, it usually tries to kind of figure out, should I not move, or what time is it? My gosh, what time is more, or it usually goes into worry or whatever. But to actually use pain, in a way it's reasonable. Not that you're going to hurt yourself, right? When you move, you move. But to use pain to bring the mind to stillness. Pain is this way. Acceptance. And then you watch the aversion to it, the worry about whatever you want, but you learn something about the ability to be conscious of something which is unpleasant in the same way that you can pay attention to the pulsing. It's the same silence. It's the same stillness. And I think that way, you know, the meditation isn't one of where you're just trying to achieve something or, you know, kind of get something and then the pain is an object that you're trying to get rid of. Pain is a part of it. How can I be at peace with pain? Okay. Sometimes in meditation it's taught that you have to sit through pain. I think all of us endure those kinds of teachings early in the piece, and then you just willfully, you know, I'm not going to move, and so on. But that doesn't make your mind peaceful, it's a kind of use of will. But how can I, like, look at any object of consciousness, be it a mood of the mind, be it pain in the body, be it a memory, a perception, how can I see that all as a movement and begin to find the sense of still knowing? In all things. Rather than that stillness being a kind of gift to nature every now and then trying to recreate it going to the same place, and then the vulture doesn't come. Or it rains. Or it's off the cliff or whatever. So that's what happens. We have a profound, you know, and this is what's so beautiful about Canada. There's so many cathedrals, aren't there? These rivers and lakes and trees and so on that they bring you to silence. But then we look at that with greed, and we look at the object, and we look at the situation, And we try to recreate it with greed. We don't realize that the object was pointing to something else. You've got it there all the time, right? And so we kind of, we miss the lesson, I guess. We miss the lesson. A good focus for your practice is, what are the kinds of moods you wake up with? When you wake up in the morning, what is consciousness doing? What kind of thoughts are there? Is it negative? Is it positive? Is it related to a discussion, argument that you had last night? What's going on in question? And you don't have to be too analytical about it. You know it right away. It's a negative mood. It's a positive mood. It's a fed up mood or whatever. And now what do you do with that? What do you do with that mood? Because what you do with that mood conditions the morning, and what you do with the morning conditions the afternoon, etc. So if I wake up and the mood of the mind is in some way very open-hearted, then expand that open-heartedness. Like, really, oh, this is wholesome. This is skillful. If the mood is very negative, don't believe it. Don't buy into it. Don't create yourself. But one has to awaken to it. Have to do it. So the first thing to do in the morning is to wake up. And that's a statement of the obvious, but it's not. So, it's not so often done, maybe. People wake up maybe around 10 in the morning. They realize where they are when they've had their coffee or whatever. But actually to awaken the mind to the moods of the mind, and then to train right there. Right there. So if the mind is negative, and it's starting to create feelings of self-pity, or feelings of fed-upness, or worry about some complexity, say, oh, this is a mood. What does a mood feel like? And then choose language which liberates you from that. Choose language. You can choose language or be chosen by the mood. Your language can be chosen by the mood, or you can choose language to create alternatives, right? That's what karma is. Choices we make. Training. So if the mood of the mind comes up that one is worried about work or health or whatever, then right there, okay, what kind of a choice can I make? I can breathe more deeply. I can say, may I be free from suffering. I can just hold attention on listening. You can do that. Your mind wants to go to practice. Listen. Calm the mind down. Now that is the big thing. It might take an extra effort of 30 seconds or whatever. But that really is where you create a foundation for enlightenment. It's just those little things daily, constantly, one awakens to the mood of the mind, one begins to really awaken to what is negative and chooses not to go there, one awakens to what is positive and chooses to go there. Right? And then the momentum of consciousness is less and less ruled by unskillful habit. The momentum of consciousness becomes more and more a foundation for freedom and peace. And that's not rocket science. It's not a big shebang that blows your head open into enlightenment. It's just very ordinary, very humble, very steady kind of intention to awaken that way. Now from that foundation, profound insights might come up. The possibility of relating to humanity is much more compassionate, much more present. So then the tendency then to make mistakes with speech, to dump moods onto people, to create other people from your moods, all that sense of a world that we create from heedlessness, that begins to fall away. If I wake up in the morning in a worrisome frame of mind, and then I'm not aware of that worry, and I begin to interpret everything that I see from worry, I create a world which is functioning from worry. And then if the worry goes into annoyance at someone, and then I interpret them through that annoyance, they create perception, they create them, so the whole world is born. The world is born into consciousness, not as a physical reality, but as a type of consciousness. And then we begin to live in that kind of world. None of us are that deluded that, you know, that we're kind of totally lost. But you can see how wars happen, you know, delusion, how all that happens from that kind of delusion. So any perceptions, any moves which create a strong sense of self in others. So if there's strong self-perceptions about you, or perceptions about other, a strong sense of me, then what's the mood that's doing that? So notice how appreciation, compassion, doesn't create a strong sense of self. You know, compassion doesn't, the metta doesn't, appreciation doesn't. There is a participation in the life of the bird. It's not about me anymore, right? The me gets out of the way. The me gets out of the way. And there's that experience. And that's why the heart practices of compassion, appreciation, and equanimity are this connection to life. With a sense of self, with a greed, hatred, delusion, and undoubtedness, and all of the hindrances. They're not intruding anymore. They're not a kind of filter of delusion which affects us. If you look at this as training, even the most seemingly pernicious, insidious, boring, recalcitrant mood can be shifted. But very recalcitrant moods require a kind of steadiness and faith. And I think we all probably have some recalcitrant moods, some things that really come up again and again and again. And the determination there is not to get rid of them, but to awaken to their arising, to awaken to their staying around for a while, and then to awaken to their cessation, to see them as moving things in consciousness, to awaken to the sense of self that wants to arise with those heavy moods, and not to believe it, not to grasp it, not to grasp the thoughts. That's what awakening is. That's what the teaching around non-attachment is trying to point to. So non-attachment does not mean that the vipaka karma, the resultant karma of these moods doesn't become conscious. It do. And this is just because the mind's been conditioned that way. But non-attachment means you no longer believe in it as a personal problem. You no longer take it personally. You no longer grasp it. It's still personal in the sense it's individual. My moods are not your moods, right? But what we mean by grasping in our personality is that sense of the self, the I-making, mind-making, which is being produced all the time. So not only do I have a mood of worry, which is coming up because of all kinds of other causes from before, but because the worry comes up, then there's this production going on. This manufacture of a sense of me. What am I going to do? And how's it going to move? Thought, and goes on and on, which keeps the mood going. Planning, clear planning, is not worry, is it? I have a problem, I think it through, okay, I'll try that, is not the same as a sense of self. It's like, to plan something, clearly, you have to think very clearly. Worry doesn't think clearly. Worry is just like scratching a wound all the time. The moods of mind which are wholesome in your life. To appreciate your own goodness. Right? So it's easy, most of us have a good critical faculty. It's easy for us to find fault with our own consciousness, but to find mudita or appreciation with our own good qualities. Mudita is the quality of appreciation, the capacity I have. You have to see something good that you've done and to say, good on you. Right? It's not egotism. It's not like you're writing a CV and you're topping up all your good qualities. It's the simple recognition of goodness. So whether I recognize goodness in your consciousness or my consciousness, it's still goodness. If I do a generous act to you, if I am kind to you, and you notice that, you go, well, that's really nice. That's really nice. That's appreciation. That's mudita. And if I do that, to you, and I appreciate it. Well, that was really nice. That's not ego. That's just really nice. It's appreciation. And that quality brings a lot of joy. It's amazing when, you know, we can be very good people, do a lot of good things, and not make that conscious. Not make that conscious. So, in Sri Lanka, you have the ping pong type. The famous ping pong. You know what ping pong is? Ping is the same as the, ping is the, if I can get this wrong, tell me. But ping is punya. And punya is merit. Right? Merit. And in Thai they say boon. So the different languages have slightly corrupted this word. But it means merit or goodness. So apparently in Sri Lanka, I don't know if they still do this, but when a child is going to school, the child is asked to remember one good deed that he or she did during the day. So maybe the child helped mom dry the dishes. And the teacher says, okay, you write that down in your ping pong tab. Help mom dry dishes. And the child is encouraged with its own goodness. It's encouraged to do goodness, but it's also recognizing goodness. And then apparently, I don't know, but apparently in the old days, and maybe now, people used to keep a ping pong tab for their whole life. And then when they died, when they were dying, someone would read their ping pong tab for them. You wash the dishes for mom. It was just a beautiful idea, isn't it? I mean, it's actually grand. Now, you could have a kind of demerit book. I mean, we're very good at keeping demerit books, right? So at the end of the day, oh, I did this wrong. I forgot to dry the cup. I left the cup of the charger. Or whatever minimal bit of wrong that we've done. And we can make a demerit book. And then that can be read to us when we die. You did this and you did that. And so, like, when you go to sleep, do you read out your generic book? Or do you read out your ping pong tab? What do you do? Now, I mean, we have to reflect on our faults and so on, so, you know, try to work on it, not to dismiss that. But to kind of bring a sense of joy and a sense of goodness, to continue to make that conscious, brings a sense of ease to the heart. Because, you know, when the heart is happy, it doesn't crave distraction. When it doesn't crave distraction, it meditates more easily. When it meditates more easily, it's happy. When it's happy, you know, it's a whole process which is self-generating in that way. So the moods of the mind is something, you know, that Ajahn Chah, that's one of the things I remember from him. See, Sat Aram was the way to sit in time. The Aramana, or this kind of object of consciousness, the moods of the mind. What is the mood? And you don't have to define, sometimes people get terribly analytical. You know, is this kind of, and they just think a lot, but you get a feeling that there's a huge difference between being angry and being happy, right? Versus being worried or thinking on it. What is the mood? Just get a sense, this is the mood. And then see what kind of thoughts that brings up, what kind of perceptions that brings up. Oh, I see. And then you begin to come back to the still knowing. Knowing the bird fly, and not when they get caught up in things. Alright, I'll leave that for contemplation.